are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hi, this is Meg Riley here in Minnesota, where we got a foot of snow to welcome us to April, but it's mostly melting now. How are you, Christina, and where are you today?
Hi, I'm Christina Rivera, and I am broadcasting from Charlottesville, Virginia, where we're expected to get snow on Saturday, which is just so wrong and is messing up. Our university has a huge volunteer effort that's held on Saturday. It's multiple locations throughout the city, and the university students come and do great volunteer work, including here at our congregation, and they're going to have to reschedule it. It's something here.
Okay, that's really weird. Michael?
Good morning, everyone. This is Michael Tino in beautiful, sunny Peekskill, New York, where there's a possibility of snow on Saturday, but I'm gonna fend it off with the pure hatred of winter. No, there might be a little bit, and you know what? That's the beginning of April in New York.
Your beloved crocuses, Michael.
My daffodils are blooming. My hyacinths are blooming. They don't care. They do not care. The daffodils and the hyacinths are entering spring, whatever the weather does.
There you go. And Jessica Star Rockers, you're doing tech for us today. You want to share what you'll be doing?
I'm back doing tech. Happy to be back. I am on the YouTube chat. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. You can find me on the CLF page, CLFUU on Twitter, or hashtag View. You can send me questions for the hosts and the guests. You can make comments, and I will pass those along behind the scenes. And I'm going to go behind the chalice so I can manage all those things.
Thank you, and welcome back from Meadville Lombard, your last classes. Well, I'm really excited today. We have some special guests with us. Susan Frederick Gray, the president. I can't even say new president anymore because you're coming up on your first year. I mean,
yeah, 9 months.
9 months in. So Susan Frederick Gray was elected at GA last year, and Carrie McDonald, the chief operating officer, are here to share what's up at the UUA. And Christina, you wanted to kind of share first that, well, I'll just let you say what you were going to say.
So two things. Actually, I wanted to mention that one of our VIEW co-hosts, Aisha Hauser, is in transit to New York. That's why she's not with us here today, where I will be meeting her. I'm driving to New York today, later on this afternoon, to participate with Middle Collegiate Church and their Revolutionary Love Conference, which runs from Friday through Sunday. So we're thrilled. There's actually lots of VIEWs that are going to be attending. So we're excited to be there. And then I just wanted to make a kind of top of the hour note to mention that obviously lots of us on this call wear many hats. And one of the hats that I wear, in addition to being VIEW co-host, is that I sit on the UA Board of Trustees. And so in that, have a working relationship with Susan and Carrie that I value very deeply, and that the board and staff have a lot of work ahead of us. We've done a lot of work and a lot of work ahead of us. And a lot of the questions that we're going to be talking about today are not just staff work, it's board work too. And but in this discussion, I'm really taking it from a point of view of being the VIEW co-host. I can't ever set down my Board of Trustees hat any more than Susan or Carrie can set down their hats. But I just wanted to kind of make a little bit of a clarification for folks.
And that is the complicated world that we all travel in. Many hats all the time. Well, Susan, let's just start with this. I mean, hey, brand new. You came in from parish ministry into presidency, and let's just start with where you are right now and what you're doing there.
Yeah, so I'm in Memphis, Tennessee, and I've been here since Tuesday as part of the commemorative events that are honoring and remembering the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination here in Memphis when he came to support the sanitation workers' strike. It was happening after two sanitation workers were killed because of equipment that was not maintained, fighting for living wage 50 years ago, as well as safe working conditions. So it's been an incredible time. I opened Tuesday night at Church of the River in Memphis, the Unitarian Church, along with Carlton Elliott Smith and Michael Crumpler, who are both on UUA staff, and then Memphis area ministers, Edie Love, Beth Lefevre, Sam Tidal. And it was really an incredible evening of worship and reflection. And then was part of the march yesterday, was up on the stage with Reverend William Barber as part of the Poor People's Campaign. There were a number of ministers, Unitarian Universalist ministers from the Deep South who were here marching together. That was incredibly powerful. And then last night, the National Civil Rights Museum held an evening of storytelling. And it was about a 3-hour long event and it involved music and art, organizers who were deep in the struggle today, like Bree Newsom and Alicia Garza was supposed to be here. I was really sad to miss her, but Tamika Mallory, and then those who were in the struggle with Dr. King, including John Lewis, including James Lawson, who really was the architect of the nonviolent struggle and the importance of nonviolence. And Michael Eric Dyson, I mean, just so many, Diana Nash, Marion Wright Edelman, people just bringing multi-generational perspectives about where we go from here, about the context we find ourselves in tonight. So it was incredibly moving event.
Amazing. Yeah. So all the local ministers are there, and then you're there as the president of the association. What does it mean for you to be, you've been at a number of national justice events since you came in, and I know that was a really central part of your desire to be president, to really be present for some of the, how does it feel and what's different when you go as a parish minister from when you show up as the president of the association? I don't know if you can describe that. I'm just curious.
Well, one difference is that people, I think when I show up, people feel seen by the whole association. I know that is, I think, how the experience is. Because when the president comes, and I feel very much, and it's one of the greatest honors of the position, is that I feel like when I show up, I'm showing up on behalf of our larger faith, our over 1,000 congregations, our covenanting communities, and congregations feel seen by all of us and held by the larger faith. So that means a lot to me, and I think it means a lot to the congregations. And if I share just one other piece, Memphis, 50 years ago, the minister of the Memphis congregation was a segregationist. He was not supportive of Dr. King. If you read what he wrote, just horrific things. And they're telling that story. They're dealing with that history on this anniversary. And I think, and that's tough, right? Because some people were members 50 years ago. And I think the other thing that happens is that I can bring some national support to the work of really pushing the conversation and the organizing work and the commitment to anti-racism and to radical justice work. When I show up preaching that, when I show up saying, this is where we need to be going, I think it helps congregations that are trying to move in that direction and dealing with the resistance and that comes through real change. So I'm grateful to be able to do that as well.
I'm grateful you're doing it. Makes a difference to me here in Minnesota that you're there in Memphis, Thanks. I mean, it is, we are a movement. We do affect each other. So I'm curious, as you've come in, and Carrie, this is for you too, one of the things you just mentioned is resistance to change, which crosses a lot of boundaries in our world. What have been some of the challenges that you, because you came in, and let's not kid ourselves, into a pretty challenging time in our movement. Good, positive, I think, but challenging.
Yeah. Carrie, would you like to speak first? You want me to say a few things?
Well, I'm happy to jump in and glad to be on this call with you all and to have this time. And I'm actually heading down to the Revolutionary Love Conference later today, too. So I will see all of our UU show of force there. So looking forward to that. You know, I think that when so I've worked at the UUA for about 7 years in different roles. And what I saw after the transition and the turmoil of the spring, as we moved into the fall, was that really the stars were aligned for the possibility of large-scale change and reimagination in our faith in a way that certainly I haven't experienced either working here or just in my lifetime looking at the UUA, because we had the senior leadership of the staff, we had the commitment of the board, we had the we had the investment in the work of the Commission on Institutional Change. I mean, and all of the other organizations that are involved in our faith movement, our professional organizations, our seminaries are really on the same page about the need for us to go back to the very roots of our faith and practice and how those have unwittingly and sometimes intentionally supported the systems of oppression that run contrary to our values. So that's exciting, right? To come in, and part of why certainly I said yes to wanting to do this work with Susan and with you all. And the other part of that is that the kind of change we're talking about is systemic. It's the policies, it's the bylaws, but it's also the culture. It's the culture as staff that we have as staff members, the culture among religious professionals across the country and subgroups of us, the culture of General Assembly. It's the relationships or the lack of relationships, a lot of areas that we've spent a lot of time this year just trying to rebuild and reinforce relationships on so many different kinds of levels, because we know that relationality is the foundation of it's trust, it's organizing, it's, you have to have that foundation, right? And so that means that trying to make systemic change means you're talking about everything. So everything's on the table, and trying to hold that big picture of possibility while focusing on, you know, here's something we need to address right now, right? Right now, we're in the middle of the blue campaign, you know, fundraising to fulfill the $5.3 million commitment. Right now, we're in the middle of a reconsideration of how we do public witness and prophetic ministry in the world, because it's so urgent, right? So we have just balancing those kind of things and not getting lost in one or the other is feels like a daily tug of war, certainly for me, and I think for a lot of us, but a privilege to have that challenge.
Yeah, I echo everything Carrie said, and just to say, you know, it is, given the context of when I came in as president, like attending to relationship has been a key priority for me, as I believe, and having moved change in congregations, like it begins with the foundation of trust and relationship and love. You know, I think you have to love people where they are to help them move forward. And I think that happens in organizations too. So a key, that was something that was just incredibly frayed. Both relationship, the way people felt connected across the faith, and trust. So that's our ongoing work. But I think it's the foundation that actually allows people or an institution to move forward in a new way.
So as Carrie said, kind of everything's on the table. So in all of that, you know, what do you prioritize? Where do you start?
Well, so we certainly started with the Promise in the Practice campaign, which is our fundraising effort for the commitment to Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism. And that's that is unrolling throughout congregations right now. I encourage anyone.
How far have we come? Do we have any numbers on it?
So I don't have the exact numbers, Carrie might, but what I know is that the UUA put forward $1 million from our endowment to make sure that we as the UUA were in, right? That we were making a commitment. We were in first. A generous donor provided $1 million to match contributions from congregations. And then congregations are right. We're doing the congregation portion now and hope to raise $1 million through congregational giving. We have some really incredible stories. A small congregation in the Massachusetts area that raised $13,000 for Blue. And we've seen people post about how incredible the resources are for the Blue campaign that are online through the UUA. and just, you know, folks actually reaching out to say this mattered to us, this made an impact. We're thrilled to be able to support this work. So that's a key priority. And that was right on the table from the beginning, as well as, you know, supporting the Commission on Institutional Change and getting off the ground. The other things that that are really priorities is one, culture change at the UUA. And Taquina Boston is now serving as the special advisor to the president on inclusion, equity, and change. We even have worked with an organization pro bono that does inclusion work in large institutions. But to think about the work around dismantling white supremacy in our faith as not just an intellectual exercise, but that at its base, it's a cultural shift. It's about learning to practice gratitude and collaboration and a deeper spiritual and religious sensibility within our faith. So all of these things, I think, have come right from the beginning. We've tried to begin in gratitude. We developed a covenant with the Leadership Council, you know, that talks about our relationship to each other, a culture of being able to name challenges and listen, to own intention and impact, as well as how we're all called to help our faith live into its mission and live into an anti-racist, anti-oppressive religious community of love and justice. So that was some of the really early things. And now I think we're transitioning into how do we continue to institute that cultural change throughout the organization? How do we skill up the staff for nurturing these cultural changes in our congregations, in the wider faith? And then just one other priority is the social justice, communication, and social media work. That was, you know, to me, this time is so urgent. The issues of justice in our world are so important. So we've tried to focus on how to amplify my social media presence as the president. And we are taking on this strategic conversation about communication and public witness at the UUA, because it just matters so much. And the context has changed around communication as well as the wider world.
Yeah, that's all so right on. And let me just add that, you know, the questions, I feel like the questions that we're wrestling with as leaders of an organization of, you know, 200 plus staff and our budget are the same questions that a lot of congregational leaders are wrestling with in their own context. They're trying to think about, how do we create inclusive hiring? How do we think about making diverse and multicultural teams and then have them succeed? It's not enough just to get people in the door. We need to set them up for success. And so the piece to it that I think we're still trying to, you know, get a better strategy about, and, you know, including being in venues like this and talking to y'all, is about how we're sharing in real time what we're learning. I mean, we're committed to transparency about this, and I hope it's pretty clear that we do not come in with all the answers. Like, we're kind of learning as we go and just trying to figure out what's the next thing we know we need to do. And so, like, that's from everything about, you know, our hiring, and how can we share a little bit about what we're learning about hiring with congregations who are asking the same questions. And we're talking about culture change and looking at, you know, there's this white supremacy culture document that was part of the teach-in materials. I mean, it's been widely known for a long time, but it was included in the teach-in materials, and looking at some of those, the elements of that culture: perfectionism, defensiveness, you know, expectation of comfort, right? And looking at where do those show up in our own staff groups and across our staff groups, and then saying, so how do we do things differently? And it's the same thing with the justice, the kinds of, you know, being clear about the justice work, the pull between trying to respond to what's happening in the 24/7 social media cycle and being relevant and where people are, but also being clear and aligned in the longer term work that takes months and years to build relationships and capacity. Like, balancing those things is something I've had so many conversations with individual ministers, religious educators, social justice committee chairs about. So we're trying to think about how we can share what we're learning in real time, so that that's valuable. And we know that we can't be leaders. We cannot sit in the place of leadership as the staff of the association if we're not doing the work that we're asking and expecting our own congregations to do.
I think just that culture change of more experimentation and allowing yourselves to fail is huge. I spent 21 years working at the UUA, and now I've been out of there for 7 or 8. And I will say that there's a lot more tolerance for failure for me at CLF than there was when I was at the UUA. Nobody blogs about what CLF, because we don't have resources that people feel possessive of or whatever. I don't know, but I just want to lift up that just doing that is a huge culture shift to be public about. We are going to mess up. So what are some of your experiments? I'm somebody who loves experiments. What are you experimenting with right now?
Well, certainly one is co-leadership of staff departments and staff groups. So we have a co-leadership team, a regional lead team in the southern region, and co-directors of the ministry and faith development department in Sarah Lambert and Jessica York. And so that is a whole new experiment. And so far it's going really well. I mean, especially I think seeing Jessica and Sarah work together, and as minister and religious educator at the head of the ministries and faith development department, is really exciting. But that's one of our new experiments and learning as we go. Carrie, you want to add to that? That's the big one that comes to mind. As well, right. Well, I mean, I will say social media, like, I know that's a little, like, I am learning how to tweet better. Well, I'm trying to tweet better. I'm not sure that I'm good at it, but, you know, we are talking about, talking with some communication consultants as well. But I'm trying to use social media in a more effective way, and we're just learning as we go, and it's letting go of perfectionism sometimes, which is a challenge for me. To put things out there and know they're not going to be perfect, but the importance to say something, to respond, is real. It really matters, even if it's not perfect. So,
yeah, another area we're doing some experimenting, and this isn't just the staff, is around General Assembly this year. So we're experimenting with a lot more kinds of networking opportunities so that people are not just in like the sit in the audience style and face front program, workshop programs as the only way to get in, access to content and meeting people who are working on information similar to them. We adjusted a bunch of things in the schedule of General Assembly to try to make this big gathering, which is often so grueling for people. The days are so long, to make them more humane. So the evening programs all start at 7 and they're done at 8:30, or supposed to be. And, the day doesn't start at 7 a.m. or right. So just like, but that meant having some trade-offs of some of the, the workshops are slightly shorter and we didn't quite get as much time in general session as maybe we would have liked to. So we're trying to use that really efficiently, playing around with some different ways of like using poster displays now that so folks, can share stories that don't have to require a whole workshop. So we're playing around with a bunch of different things because we know that General Assembly is an opportunity to model some of the things we want to. It's the best place to model culture change. And I think we're going to be doing, and the board has really been starting to talk about this in their meetings also, about looking at more experiments for ways to structure General Assembly to have the conversations we want to have and not get hidebound by our own rules of procedure, our own, timelines for planning that don't let us do the things we need to do, and use General Assembly to learn some of that and help people experience that experimentation for themselves.
I'll add another piece, and I want to lift up the leadership of the Board of Trustees and Alandria Williams and Barb Grieve, our co-moderators, because we are doing board meetings very differently. And that's an experimental model. We break into small groups when we're discussing a particular topic. We engage participants in the board meeting and they have work to do during board meetings. So I think that is a big change, and seeing how that shifts the culture of the board. As well as our discernment, the quality of our discernment. And I also want to lift up that we're supporting more community for staff people of color at the UUA. And there was an all-day retreat of staff members of color. And out of that, some input and feedback about what would be helpful, how they see what's needed to help transform the culture of the UUA and to support the success of staff members of color. And so they're coming with suggestions, and we're going to try to implement and experiment with those suggestions to help, you know, just create the environment of inclusion, equity, and real transformation at the UUA.
So kind of piggybacking on that, Susan, we've heard a lot in UU World has published an article about UU religious professionals of color really struggling in their ministries right now in numbers that we haven't, at least anecdotally, because we haven't tracked it before, but really know, but really feels like I would use the term crisis. So what do you all see as the UUA's role in that, both in serving those congregations in crisis and also, you know, just from a broader, more global perspective of, you know, supporting both congregations and the religious professionals?
Let me just offer a couple of things, because I was actually just in a, we were just in a meeting about this yesterday. And so I want to share a couple of things. Yeah, we thought it was really important also to just go, like, to go on the record with UU World noting that we're having these observations, because we've been talking about this. The board's been talking about it. We've been talking about the number and the different texture of the ways that ministry for religious professionals of color of all, you know, ministers and religious educators and musicians and administrators and has been harder this year. And so there's been a lot of internal conversation, but we wanted to make sure that that was, that there was more public awareness of that too. And I think there's going to be more public discussion about that. So I think there's really, you know, three different kinds of things that we're trying to do. And not all of this is stuff that we can do ourselves, but as we're thinking about it, the one is this is what needs to happen urgently right now. And so, when we get called or we become aware of a conflict situation in a congregation, it's often like things have gotten bad and that's why we get called. And so we're trying to think about how we support those conflicts a little bit differently rather than just one individual staff person offering their expertise. We're doing a lot more leveraging the wisdom of our own internal staff, getting folks from different perspectives to, you know, do case studies and advise together on that so that we're providing more holistic guidance, which takes more time, but is really important. And we're also bringing in more consultants in different ways, recognizing where, you know, where our staff lack capacity just because of, I mean, sometimes it's just because, you know, we're trying to do a lot of different things and we don't want anybody to get shortchanged, but sometimes we need a different set of expertise. And so bringing folks in there. So, and just raising the conversation and making sure that our own systems are talking to one another and we're in better conversation with Lareda and the UUMA. And so not getting stuck in our silos in the ways that we're trying to respond. I think that the better, you know, longer term or just medium term approach is to try to invest a lot more in healthy ministry. It's a whole lot easier to prevent, you know, deeply troubling conflict than it is to get out of it once you're already there. And so we are already looking at how can we invest in the health of new settled ministers, new staff, you know, new formations of staff teams, like for the coming church year. We've been putting together or curating some of the tools that folks can use to self-assess their own health, but thinking about different ways in which we can try to encourage, name, tell stories about healthy teams and also healthy ways of engaging the inevitable difference that comes up in when you have teams of folks who have different backgrounds. I mean, conflict is not inherently a terrible thing. Sometimes it represents like pushing against stuff that needs to be pushed at. And if we don't have good frameworks for engaging that, then it can become really costly. And we know that those costs are not always borne equally. And so that conflict transformation into what change needs to happen is really where what we're trying to hold up. So we're looking ahead in the coming months, like how can we make some investments in health? And I think the big term question, this is really where, you know, this is not just in UUA staff hands, especially, is about our broader systems for how we credential and train our religious professionals of color at every stage. You know, we need to think about how do we create the uniquely supportive experience based on people's needs, which is definitely about race, but it's also about folks who are gender nonconforming and folks who have differing abilities, and how much our systems are built within really an expectation. And we sort of retrofitted them a lot, but what if we really thought creatively and started fresh and thinking about our systems for training professional leaders and also volunteer leaders, and how leaders are scouted and recruited, and the pipelines that we have for leadership in our association. So that's the bigger picture work as well.
Are you also looking at how congregations behave? Because I know there's beyond categorical thinking when congregations are looking to call a minister, but you know, what you're talking about is supporting the canaries in the coal mine in a way. I mean, you're talking about how to support the people who bear a disproportionate amount of the pain, which is great. I'm all for it. But I also think if congregations don't get some help, I mean, we just see these patterns over and over of, oh my God, this is the best. Oh no, this is the worst. Get out. I mean, it just, I've been around a long time. I've watched, you know, a lot of these systems come through, and I've just watched a lot of wonderful people of color leave for, you know, 27 years now. So I just wonder, you know, how congregations are held accountable in this. Is there a piece of that that you're looking at?
So I thank you, Meg, for lifting that up, because, and I just lift up that this is really a systemic issue. And so thinking about how we change the system is the long-term work. Yes, to the question of how do we hold congregations accountable. And it's, you know, it's something I think, you know, we still have questions about, but I am trying, and Carrie and I've had some experience with this. Instead of saying, what can't we do because of congregational polity, what can we do? And one of the things that's clear to me is that when congregations are in transition, ministerial transition, that is the time when they most need the UUA. That is a time where we could actually make a greater impact in a congregation if we looked at that time and what our role was in that time. So one of the things that's happened is beyond categorical thinking isn't required, right? But I think we could look at our transition system and say, this is what transition is, and this is what you do. And beyond categorical thinking is something that you do. And how do we resource that? That's, I mean, certainly resources are always a part of the conversation at the UUA. But I think about, where do you have the most impact, and where do you have the most leverage, and how do you focus on those areas to try to actually invest in change? So I don't have all the answers there or the resources yet, but that to me is the area where we really should be thinking, that transition time and the startup time. And we are talking about what can we do around startups that is actually nurturing a shared conversation between the new leadership and the congregation, as well as startups for staff groups that have multiracial or diverse staff teams. How can we provide startup resources for those staff teams? So that someone's in there, the UUA's in there saying, here are issues that are going to come up, right? Here's, you know, it's not time to congratulate yourself. This is, you know, if you've hired a religious professional of color, race is going to be part of the conversation now all the time. This is the beginning of deep work, not the end of the work. So, and then making sure that they have resources, they know who to call, how to call, all those kinds of things. But we can't, you know, I think there are times when we can be more effective and more influential, and focusing on those times is at least, and it's not the only answer, but it's a big piece of, I think, what could start to move the change among our congregations themselves.
Yeah. Let me just give one other quick example of that, if I can, Meg, because your point is right on, you know, and it's congregations are employers, right? And they're the ones who ultimately make decisions about any individual staff. The new standard ministerial contract has language around not just the staff, but the congregation's commitment to anti-racism, anti-oppression, and multiculturalism. And that's coming out in beta form this year. And also, we're working on just polishing up some language around that expectation of you know, systems of managing disagreements and conflict, that that's going to be a part of what you're entering into. And that's not, you know, that's a part of healthy systems for all leadership teams. And it's especially important when we're trying to, you know, put together diverse teams in a more monolithic congregational environment.
I was just going to say, Paula Cole Jones has been saying for 20 years that interim ministry is really critical in this. And I did the interim ministry training last summer, and this wasn't talked about at all. It was about change, but there was nothing about here's an opportunity, you know, and I'm curious about that. I mean, I just think until we start looking through all the systems and how they impact each other, it's going to be hard to move. But yeah, it's great. It's exciting to hear what you're doing. Sorry, Michael, I interrupted you.
That's all right. And the more we talk, the more parts my question has. So I apologize. You've talked about institutional change and cultural change and systemic change. And I know from my own experience and study of all those things that one of the ways that white supremacy culture perpetuates itself is by resisting that change. And I know from having worked at the UUA also for 6 years that there's so much that needs to get done, that just needs to get done, that that I can imagine trying to do all the things that need to get done being a point of resistance as well. So I'm wondering where else you're finding resistance as you're experimenting, as you're being more transparent, because more transparency probably comes with more pushback. Also, where are you finding resistance, and how can those of us who are out in our congregations help take down some of that resistance for you, or be on your side in this in a certain way?
Thank you, Michael. That's a great question. Gosh, I mean, the way I most feel resistance is from individuals like out in the movement, you know, questioning the language that we're using to talk about white supremacy, a culture of white supremacy, frustration, you know, financial, you know, unwillingness to invest because of the direction that the UUA is taking. But I want to say that, like, that is small compared to the number of people who are really feel ready for change, leadership that's leading change in congregations. But I also hear from ministers about how they're navigating resistance in their own systems. So I think, continuing to just remember that what we're trying to do is to live more deeply into our Unitarian Universalist theology. We're trying to live more fully into our faith that calls us to love one another, that calls, that reminds us that no one is outside of the circle of love. And so systems of oppression and dehumanization that perpetuate in our system, either locally, as well as nationally and internationally, that we have to be part of the movement and part of the leaders to knock those systems down, to dismantle those systems. So I do think trying to share the kind of opportunity and spiritual maturity that's present in this work is helpful. That this isn't just the political thing. This is about walking more fully into our humanity and seeing one another's humanity more fully and resisting these structures that divide us and make our hearts afraid. So to me, that's why, you know, it's one piece of this work is that this is the faith I love and the faith that I've been called to. And I want to see it live into its fullness. So that's, I think, sharing that message is good. The good news of this work is important. I love that you said that actually just the pace of work can be a form of resistance. I think that's really insightful. And it's also a part of the culture, right? I mean, this we've talked about this in the culture of white supremacy, of overwork, of perfectionism, of quantity, over quality. you know, how do we shift some of those things so we're actually making room for more creativity, more humanity in our work? And that's not easy. And we're doing all this in a time when expectations are really growing. And we may have to, there may be some things we have to just let go of so we can do other things more. And so I guess another way to help, if there's something, like there have been some times when I've been with colleagues or groups and I've had to say, you know, we're not taking that on as a priority because this cultural change work, this anti-racism, anti-oppression, dismantling white supremacy in our larger faith, this is taking priority. So I think kind of supporting that is as valuable as a and coming first is also important because there will be things that get less attention in this work. But that hopefully because of this work, when we get back there, it's going to unroll with a whole new lens.
Yeah, that's
And feedback, you know, given telling us when you see things, helpful feedback is good. We do mess up and we don't know. I don't always see the fullness of things. So I welcome emails, you know, folks saying, hey, don't forget this, or, you know, it's good to be connected and in relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, you know, having people who are advocating in every single context for this work is super important, because the other piece to this is about the fact that there's so much means that it's exhausting, right? And thinking about like who can tap out and who can't. And also, it is not going to work for us to create an environment in which people are simply worked to the bone year after year, right? Like burning people out, that's also a part of white supremacy culture. Is not having human-centered environments where people can succeed and flourish. And so that, you know, sometimes I think what would be so helpful is just to have like more people who are willing to get better in their own context without waiting for the perfect answer to that. You know, I have conversations sometimes with congregational leaders that are like, no, we want to do this work, and we would love some best practices, and we would love a curriculum, or we would love for you to tell us what to do. Of course, sometimes that's so they can tell us that they don't want to do that. But, you know, holding that aside, right? And like, and then I have these unsatisfying answers of like, well, we're kind of learning as we go. And so have that not be then so people holding back, expecting their own perfectionism, but being willing to keep going, knowing they're making mistakes. I make so many mistakes. I make mistakes every day. Yesterday, I sent an email to a bunch of people. And one of the people on the email sent me back an email saying like, wow, I really felt like the way that you couched that email totally erased my work. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm sorry. And then I sent an email correcting that perception, right? Like that was the thing that happened to me yesterday where I totally messed up for one of my staff people who I feel super accountable for. We all do this, right? And so having the like strength of spiritual ego to just own your mistakes and not have that hold you back in the work that has to keep going. Because the work has to keep going. And for those of us who then get held up in that, that means that it falls on someone else. So just to name the stamina required and to help one another take the breaks when we need to, so that we don't just get totally consumed.
It's that balance between relationship and relationships take a lot of time, you know, which is, I think, why we try to shortcut through. We all try to shortcut through them in various ways, and it usually bites us somehow. I wanted to name that Clarice Mason said that this was moving more fully into our humanity. So, yeah, and I think all of it is, you know, that all of it of just being human, learning to apologize and have humility about that you messed up yesterday, and guess what, Carrie, you'll mess up again today, and so will I, and every one of us, you know. And so how do we stop spending our time critiquing other people's lives and, you know, get out there and do what we can do? I think that's just huge. So I'm curious what you think are the most exciting edgy things going on. You know, I'm always interested in edges. Like, are there interesting conversations? Are there big dreams? Things that, yeah, you know, you're busy. Clearly you've got what you're doing, but you know, that you can see around the edges, something new or interesting that people are talking about even?
So what feels edgy and new to me and is and a dream I have, I don't know if it'll take root, but I think it's starting to, is what if as Unitarian Universalists, we took a serious long-term commitment into working to oppose mass incarceration and the systems of criminalization. Like, to me, that is a system in our society that is so dehumanizing at every level. And that the damages that it creates to whole communities, to children, generationally, is just horrific. And so, to me, I feel like around immigration, not perfect, but like we actually did shift much of the association's understanding about immigrant rights, about the injustice of the immigration system. And we've got churches doing detention visits and court support. And I was just here in Memphis and talking to a minister in New Orleans who was saying what a difference it makes when church people and white people come into courtrooms and sit and watch what happens. So I just think, like, what would it mean if we actually as a whole faith began to really look critically at policing, began to really look critically at criminalization as the new Jim Crow, as a dehumanizing form of control of people of color and the poor, and said, you know, this is wrong and we are going to fight this the way that we fought other systems in the past, in coalition, in partnership, like we're not the leaders, but like, what if we really opened our hearts to that? That to me is edgy. I think it's a place that other faith communities may not really throw down on, you know, because, you know, obviously the system of policing is so deep in our country.
And that's so theologically grounded for us.
Yeah.
You know, it's because it's really a system of Calvinism that says some people are preordained to spend their life in jail, and they're just going to go there for any time. And some people are preordained to have everything. And that, you know, and so I think if you look at mass incarceration as one of the U.S. implementations of a theology that we vehemently have stood against, you know, that's who we came into being saying, no loving God, or call it what you want, would create that system. I think we have some really, you're talking my language, Susan.
Yeah.
You're talking my language.
That's my dream.
Exciting. Yeah. How about you, Carrie?
Well, I mean, yes, so much amen to that. And like, just to say, that is the stuff that we're doing as association staff. And we are part of the ways in which we're trying to rethink our public witness a little bit more is about trying to follow the energy and the passion and the activism that individual UUs and UU congregations are doing. We have some amazing young next generation organizers who are doing this work outside of their faith communities, but as UUs. And we have incredible work that congregations are doing. I mean, the number of congregations that are sanctuary churches has like more than tripled since the election. And that's a narrow tactic, but it's like that represents a real scaling up of commitment. You know, the engagement with not just Black Lives Matter in general, but the cutting edge of policing and incarceration specifically as one of the most violent expressions of racism in this country right now. I hear this. I mean, it's the stories of the individual congregations and leaders doing that work in their own communities are really powerful and exciting for me. And I also, like, I actually think that this institutional change work is exciting, and I'm a little bit of a dork, but that's why I have this job. And, you know, that includes some things like way better data systems to just keep track of things so that they don't live in everybody's minds and their own little Excel spreadsheets on their computer, so we can hold relationship across the association, 'cause we like know what people's names are. But it's also, you know, so my former role, I was the outreach director. And before then I was the youth and young adult ministries director. And in both of those roles, I did a lot of work with like the entrepreneurial emerging ministry, which was a conversation, you know, came out of this Congregations and Beyond paper that Peter Morales put together almost 6 years ago now. And I just want to say that, you know, I was part of the push for years to get us to like rethink faith given the trends in American religious life. And that had some really important, it empowered some folks doing some really amazing ministry. It got us to a new level of conversation. But I think some of the things that that ran aground on were just people's inability to get over the same things that we're raising now as being symptomatic of white supremacy culture. The need for perfectionism, the inability to like just try new things, the inability to listen to perspectives and experiences from folks at the margins, right? Lack of truth and honesty and transparency, the expectation of comfort. So all of these things that we had that had sort of stymied a deeper and fuller way that we might just reimagine our faith are the same things that we're actually trying to confront now. And it feels like that gives us more theological commitment and more of a tangible sense of what needs to change for us to unlock all the potential that we talk about, right? And so I'm really excited to kind of see the merging of the like those pushes in a way that I think is going to be transformational for our faith. I mean, that's
I almost understand you, but I'm really excited by it. I always love it when I almost understand something. Can you give an example of what you're, because I think you're thinking about some really specific things that I don't know.
Sure. So I would give this workshop, or I would give workshops in which I would tell people, if you want to basically reach a different set of people than the ones who are sitting in your pews right now, you have to understand how you are experienced by people who are not you. Which seems like a basic point, but people would be like, yeah, I guess that is true, right? Like, it's not an accident that the people who are in your church are in your church, okay? It's all the signals you send off. It's like what you talk about, the language you use, all this stuff, right? And so then people would be like, well, how do I figure that out? You know, and I'm like, well, you could start by just talking to other people. You know, I had a workshop once where I said, okay, can you have coffee with 5 people in your community who are not members of your church and just get a sense of like what they think would be helpful for your church to do and like anything they may know about you? And people were like deeply uncomfortable with this. I was like, could you follow 5 activists in your community on Twitter and just know, like, just learn from them a little bit, right? And see to get their take on things. And like that was the level that I felt like I needed to operate at with folks who are trying to take it from this more generic, think about who you want to reach, try some things out, do some design thinking in your context. That's a phrase that sometimes folks use. It's just about experimenting, experifail, right? But if we think about those same issues from the point of view of decentering whiteness or the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant New England cultural milieu that has birthed Unitarian Universalism in so many ways. And I say that as someone who has like family legacy as a part of that. So I'm talking about me too, me as well. And then we see that the ways in which we assume what church does and who this is for and who deserves to be here, that assumption of comfort and of the learned language that we use, the worship of the written word, the discomfort with expressing emotion and like visceral expressions of faith, the lack of accessibility to our congregations are all symptomatic of a white supremacy culture. I mean, it's written in a dozen different places, right? And people are a lot more, so they can see that and they feel that and they feel the urgency of that in a different kind of way than all of the mystery visitor reviews of your congregation would ever point to, right? But if you say it's immoral from our sense of morality, the ways in which you limit the expression of Unitarian Universalism to this, you know, set of theologies that has like such European references rather than the fuller expression of even history in this country and wisdom from different traditions in our own communities, that is against our faith tradition. It is not just tactically problematic for recruitment. Is that clear?
So, I'm wondering, Carrie, that's clear to me. So that's exciting and also difficult, but exciting, and we can do difficult things, right? We have to have faith that we can do difficult things. So I'm wondering, like, you all talked about reimagining communications and prophetic witness and ministry. And I'm wondering if that sort of thinking that you just talked about is part of that reimagining, like how people perceive us when we talk as an association of congregations. And is there a way to talk differently to be perceived differently? And if it is, could you tell us about that? Or Susan?
Yeah, I'll let Carrie speak maybe to more of the specifics, but we're with our communication strategic thinking, we are talking about UU adjacent as a way to think about who we're trying to communicate to and with. So there is some communication that's very UU specific, but how can I, as the president, not just be talking, and the UUA, not just be talking to UUs, but people who are UU adjacent, people who are movement leaders or progressive thought leaders. And we're actually, the other thing is we're bringing in consultants who are not UU and bringing in communication folks who are not UU. So already from day one, they look at us, you know, with, they bring the outside perspective of who we are. So Carrie, you have more specifics, you lead that work, but.
Yeah, I think that's right. So not assuming people have this frame of reference of being a UU in the pew congregational member, and especially the more, like the broader theological and prophetic frames that we're using, and we talk about justice in the world, like that doesn't need to be limited to, you know, somebody who turned in their pledge card last year. So the thing that I would add also is that part of this is actually moving away from understanding that work as public witness, which is a lot about visibility and is grounded in a time when organizing, you know, even 10 years ago was so much more about mainstream media attention. Not that that isn't important, but it is really, it's one tactic of a series of tactics that we're using. And some of that, so we're just experimenting with the language of public prophetic ministry rather than just public witness, and saying it's always important to have a strong UU voice, but that visibility is not always a goal. Those have some unfortunate ability-related connotations I want to acknowledge. The point is just that media attention is not the only goal. And sometimes organizing behind the scenes is a really important thing. And I want to gently use the example of some of the work that happened in Charlottesville, which Chris and Susan were both directly a part of. And so there's a lot of power in that. And I don't want to share any of that story from my, you know, from my perspective. What I want to name is that there was the, like in the front of the parade role. And there was the, all the organizing that happened to go up into, to get that to happen, and ways in which, you know, our national staff tried to support folks on the ground. And then there was the helping people respond and all, deal with the trauma and the after effects. And so all of that feels like a part of our organizing work and the ways that we're trying to support these like incredibly like historic moments in the history of our country. They don't always get named, right? Because some of it is you have to be able to do things just with appropriate discretion and in relationship, and even being able to just show up and be helpful is not a given. So just to name that, it is so much broader, and being able to live into that gives us the ability to build relationships with a whole different set of kind of community partners, because we're bringing a different set of things to the table.
Susan, any last words? We're coming up on the hour.
You know, I think this is back to the communication piece, but also how can we amplify the voices of movement leaders that we're following and that we feel like UUs need to hear? And I think, you know, we're looking at that as another way in which we're not just communicating to our folks, or it's not just our voices, Unitarian Universalist leaders or the UUA, that are communicating, but we're really trying to build partnership that way by amplifying some of the work of non-UU movement organizers. And that's something that I think is going to unfold over time, but I think it's really important. How do we use our resources as Unitarian Universalists in partnership with movement leaders? So I'm grateful for this time. Thank you for having Carrie and I on the show. It's an incredible honor and privilege to serve as UUA president. And it is a gift and a joy to work with Carrie McDonald, with the other staff of the UUA, with the Board of Trustees. So thank you all for participating,
so much for
watching.
Coming. Hopefully it won't take so long to get you back. It's really wonderful to, and really exciting. Fresh leadership is just really exciting on all levels, board, staff, congregational life, you know. I wanted to mention, Peter Bowden had mentioned that it's Climate Change Month, one of many things we didn't get to today. Wanted to talk to you about the Dreamers. Here we are. We're never going to have enough time to talk about everything that's important. But I'm really glad that we're in it together. Next week, we'll be talking about prison ministry with Mandy Goheen and Karen Mooney. And we'll see you then.
This has been an episode of The View. If you would like to learn more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.